Well, good morning. And yes, I was with you all last year over at the EEOB in the Indian Treaty Room. And I remember I had a very difficult time getting in. I had a lot easier time getting in the building here this morning with my ID than I did getting in EEOB last year, where I got turned away and had to go back a second time in order to get in to speak to you. So it was a lot easier. Didn't realize we were going to have TV. Staff tells me I've got a face made for radio, so you guys in the radio business will be okay. I don't know about the cameras. A little chilly here in Washington, D.C. this morning. In fact, I just told Catherine if it gets any colder, she's going to have to start knitting jackets for my corn that's trying to come up. It's a little cold on the corn that we've got planted, and as wet as it's been in Delaware and as cold as it's been, it's having a very difficult time of coming up. So hopefully the weather will warm up later this week and we can get the crops out of the ground and start getting some soybeans planted as well. Thank you for the introduction. I sort of hate that when they do that because it sounds like I can't hold a job, but I have been busy the last few years. You know, it was an honor to have been appointed by President Obama and confirmed by the Senate as the Undersecretary for the Farm and Foreign Agricultural Service last year. A very big position, not just dealing with farm programs, but it also deals with the Foreign Agricultural Service, which is our foreign supplies of foreign food assistance as well as our trade. And with the departure last week of Deputy Secretary Merrigan, I was designated by the White House to be the acting Deputy Secretary. So my role has changed just a bit from when we last met last year. So I've only been in the job about a week, so you'll have to bear with me, please. It's been quite a bit of a change. This week, you picked a great week to be in Washington, D.C. I don't know how you all got so lucky, being farm broadcasters and being in Washington, D.C., the week that it looks like the Senate and the House will be marking up the farm bills. So I don't know who picked this week, but I tell you what, they sure did pick a good one. So whoever was responsible for that, I would take it all the credit that you could possibly get, because that's not something that happens very often. You know, we're currently working under a 9-month extension until this coming September 30th under the old farm bill. We have the slow burn of the sequester. That's underway. Absent any further agreements, we're looking at a spending cut of $85 billion throughout our federal operations alone. We're looking at a $1 billion reduction here for the Department of Agriculture, which the Secretary, I'm sure, will point out when he speaks to you later, is about $1 billion below 2009 spending levels. And think about that for a minute, how costs have increased and everything, and we're going to be at about $1 billion below 2009 spending levels. You know, we started again with a CR for funding to get us through the rest of the year. So on top of the sequester, there was an additional about 2.7% on top of that that we had to deal with. So it has been a very challenging time here at USDA this year, and having to deal with the Farm Bill extension, the sequester, and then with the cuts that we had to take in the CR. So it has led to both uncertainty, certainty, and then again uncertainty with the Farm Bill. You know, and we're going to have to continue that theme, I think, of doing more with less. But it's not like doing more with less is a new concept for agriculture. Our farmers and ranchers across the country have been doing more with less for a very long time. Innovative new technologies and approaches have created tremendous improvements in crop yields, litter size, milk production, calf weight. In fact, the Secretary likes to point out, and I hope I'm not stealing his thunder, he'll kill me when he comes in if I am, but back at about 1950, a dairy cow produced about 5,500 pounds of milk. That was the average. And if you'll look at today, the average, the herd average is over 20,000 pounds. And think about how we got there. through the science, to technology, through genetics. We've come a very long way, and agriculture has, in fact, involved not just in livestock production, but crop production as well. And it's good for domestic food security, but it also means that fewer Americans have direct firsthand experience about how we produce our food. And that, I think, translates into an even more important question about how national policymakers actually view agriculture today. Is it viewed as a priority? You know, last May we celebrated the 150th anniversary of President Lincoln signing into law, the law that created U.S. Department of Agriculture. In fact, ladies and gentlemen, tomorrow will be the 151st anniversary of the creation of the Department of Agriculture. And when President Lincoln created it, 90% of the 32 million people that lived in the United States lived in rural areas. And today, only 16% of our population live in rural areas, and that's less than 1% of them are farmers and ranchers, and one-tenth of those, one-tenth of that 1%, are producing nearly 80% of what the other 350 million Americans consume, as well as what we export to other countries. In the past 30 years, the United States population has grown by about 90 million people. While we have lost about 40 million acres of farmland, and that's the equivalent of losing every farm in Ohio and Illinois, taking those out of production, yet we still continue to grow plenty of food, not just for our consumers here in the United States, but throughout the world. Think about that. Think about that loss and how we've been able to increase production and continue to produce huge amounts of meat and protein, as well as the grains, but having lost that many acres over the last few decades. And the reason behind, because of the reason behind all of this production, if you look at those that came before us, they set the stage. The farmers years ago set the stage by being willing to adopt new technologies. Drought and pest-resistant crop genetics have allowed us to continue that expansion to boost yields. If you look at the animal veterinary sciences and how we've been able to increase weight gains, litter size, milk production, again, our farmers have been willing to adapt and to use the new technology so that they can continue to push those boundaries of yields and production. And isn't it one of the greatest ironies of agriculture innovation that modern farm age that our greatest success leads to a great criticism from folks who no longer live in rural America? Think about that. You've all heard it. How we've been criticized by those that are not in agriculture production about the practices and some of the things that we do. You know, if you look at why Americans spend probably about the lowest amount of their disposable income of food on food of anywhere in the world, it's because of our farmers and ranchers and the ability for them to embrace the technology so that they can continue to push those yields, those weight gains, so that we can keep the prices to our consumers as low as they are. I mean, there's a reason why we are producing, or our consumers have access to the most abundant, cost-effective, and safest food supply in the world. And that reason is because we have the best farmers and ranchers. They embrace the technology. You know, we've seen an erosion of the representation at the national level, which is why a whole city might be, in fact, represented by 14 people in the House of Representatives, why two entire rural states combined might only have 17. Think about that for a minute. When you have one city whose representation in the House of Representatives equals almost that to two entire state legislators. I mean, there's a reason why we're having difficulties getting some things like farm bills passed through Congress. And I think, you know, that just identifies in itself the challenges that we face. That you yourselves face, because as your audience continues to shrink, the challenges that you have in communicating agriculture, its importance, its relevance to not just to your listeners but to others, and trying to promote agricultural views. You know, take a look at USDA. Last year, while we waited on the House of Representatives to restore the expired disaster assistance programs, we cut the disaster declaration time by more than half, from an average of 89 days to under 25 days last year. We reduced emergency loan rates from 2.1% down to 2.1% from 3.75%. That had been locked in place for 20 years. We again heard complaints from the agricultural community about those emergency loans. We reacted. We also persuaded all 16 insurance companies to waive the interest because of a timing shift in the Farm Bill, to waive the interest to allow our producers to pay their premiums most of the time after their crop had been harvested. Released up to 20, or not to 20, released up to $200 million worth of forage by opening up CRP lands that had not been opened previously. And because the drought was so extensive and because our farmers and ranchers were having such a difficult time, we worked with the conservation groups, we worked with the states to open up CRP lands to provide $200 million worth of forage for the livestock out there last year. And we purchased $170 million worth of pork, lamb, chicken, and catfish for federal food nutrition assistance programs. Those are things that we did here in USDA to help our producers through one of the most difficult droughts in the history of the United States. And now we know that agriculture takes its marching orders not just from the sun, rain, and markets, but things over which, you know, we have very little control over. But, you know, folks do have control over a farm bill. And with that control comes a responsibility that farm bills are enacted in a timely manner so that our farmers and ranchers have certainty, so that they can start planning and preparing for that next year, for that crop. And what's happened this past year with not having a farm bill for so many months, with not having the disaster provisions extended and going into a drought situation last year, that caused a great deal of concern for our farmers and ranchers out there. And then the uncertainty of not knowing what was going to happen by not having a farm bill just built, piled on that uncertainty and the problems that our agricultural community faced. You know, agriculture gets about 15 to 16 cents for every food dollar that's spent in a grocery store. When less than 1% of us grow the food and 15% of us need help to purchase the food, you know, that's an important link between both having a strong farm programs and strong food programs, because in the end, ultimately, those programs help everyone. And it's especially true since city folks participate in food programs at lower rates than our rural folks do, with city participation declining and rural participation growing recently. Now, here's something that I would like for all of you to think about, and this doesn't have to do with SNAP. The average household wastes 20 pounds of food a month, or more than $2,000 worth of food each year, by spoilage, by buying too much, or throwing it into the garbage. That's about $6 a day in those families compared to an average of $9 a day for families that are receiving SNAP. Think about the amount of food that we waste in this country each year. And those who say that farmers and the cowmen can't be friends, and we want to talk about that food versus fuel distracting us from squabbling among ourselves. But when grocery stores and restaurants and apartment high-rises and condominium complexes waste about $165 billion worth of food each year, with 55% of that coming from meat, poultry, fish, and dairy, how much corn was wasted? How much of our feed grains was actually wasted in the production of that food that ultimately was wasted and thrown away? that's something else that we need to take a serious look at, about the waste that we use and what goes into the production of that waste. What is the ultimate cost? How much better job can we do? How many more people can we feed each year if we don't waste the food that's produced by our farmers and ranchers? You know, and I have a very difficult time, and I think many of you should too, with a view about the weakening role of government in ensuring a strong safety net, not just for our farmers and ranchers out there, but for any American who plays by the rules, but because of circumstances beyond their control, suddenly needs help to regain their footing, whether it's a market drop, whether it's weather disaster, crop insurance, medical insurance, or food, or recovering from wounds suffered while serving our country. When Americans need help, we should be there to provide that assistance. When they play by the rules, we need to be there. In the 1930s was not known for strong crop prices and tight supplies like we have today, and that's because when the government created the Federal Surplus Relief Corporation, which brought farm products at a discount and distributed them to those that actually needed the relief. A lot of changes from the 1930s to today. With the overproduction, with the declining prices versus today, tremendous amount of production, and extremely high prices. If you look at electricity and telephones and running water that existed only in the big cities then, with barely 10% of American farmers having any such convenient utilities or plumbing, and hybrid seeds were so new that most producers feared exploring this unfamiliar technology, unlike today where we readily adopt the new technology, while their crops dried up in the Dust Bowl and in the drought. You know, all of that was about to change because under President Roosevelt, the Rural Electrification Administration was created, helping rural Americans afford new telephone and electric infrastructure in an era when folks found consensus. Congress directed the USDA to construct four laboratories to discover new uses and markets for those crop surpluses. And I think you just heard Dr. Wotecki and talk about the important role that USDA plays in research in all types of new technologies, crop production, animal production, as well as many other sciences that we're viewing today to further agriculture production and help our consumers as well as our producers. You know, under those days, under Secretary of Agriculture from another Secretary of Agriculture from the great state of Iowa, Mr. Henry Wallace, he said results from research are likely slow in coming. But we must not think about the weeks or months, but we must think about the years to come. In just 36 months, though, after this was started, USDA researchers at one lab discovered a strange mold from cantaloupe that, when by adding a corn liquor and milk sugar, created a new strain of penicillin that could be manufactured in massive quantities. You know what that led to? Massive production of penicillin that helped save many of our troops during the D-Day invasion. Months later, USDA labs discovered compounds that effectively exterminated lice, blocking the spread of typhus among European war refugees and U.S. troops. Today, USDA has a network of more than 100 research laboratories. But with GPS, Wi-Fi, and iPads commonplace, the notion of a farm without running water, without electricity or telephone today seems unthinkable. And 95% of today's corn are hybrid seeds, producing 20% more on 25% fewer acres than in the 1930s. But we have a responsibility to continue that investment in research and in our rural economy. And we hope that it doesn't end. While waiting for Congress to address a $1 trillion backlog in the nation's neglected and deteriorating transportation and communications infrastructure, USDA has moved forward installing modern broadband service to 7 million rural residents and 250,000 rural businesses, creating more than 25,000 jobs. We modernized more than 91,000 miles of electric lines that serve more than 25 million Americans, and we've invested in more than 900 educational facilities, 475 libraries, more than 1,000 healthcare facilities, and more than 3,400 public safety facilities. Think about that. When you look at a deteriorating infrastructure around the United States, think about what USDA has been able to do in the last few years. And that's not all. We've provided more than 6,700 loans and grants for water and wastewater community infrastructure and invested more than 5,500 distance learning and telemedicine opportunities, improving the availability of health care throughout rural America. And over the past 4 years, more than 500,000 farmers and ranchers have volunteered to enroll a record number into USDA's conservation programs, helping to transform the countryside from its past ranking as the lowest in wetlands and wildlife preservation to now the very top in protecting those resources. And if you look at what just CRP does alone, you know, we've protected 8 billion tons of topsoil in 26 years. We protect over 200,000 miles of rivers and streams, and each and every year we sequester over 50 million tons of harmful gases. That's just what CRP alone has done. And 3,100 companies today turn agricultural waste into new products, something else that research and technology has allowed us to do. Hog manure into asphalt, corn cobs into plastic bottles. And USDA has set a goal this year to create and invest in another 50 new companies that will manufacture bio-based products using these very same approaches. And no matter how hard that debate swings from farm programs versus SNAP benefits, from more cuts or more revenues, we also know that when one insists on 100% of one's goals versus nothing, the result, unfortunately, is typically nothing except an unbelievable amount of time wasted. It's time that we start working together. When you want for everything and are not willing to compromise, we end up with the gridlock that stopped our farm bill last year. So it's time that we start working together for the good of all Americans, and especially for agriculture. We have so much to offer. If you look at what we've done in trade, we've just had the four biggest years in agricultural trade that this country has ever experienced. The year before last, we set a record of $137 billion in agricultural trade. Last year, we just missed it at just over $135 billion. But this year, we are on target to export another record of agricultural products from the United States. We're looking at $142 billion worth of agricultural trade. With that, that means jobs. For every $1 billion, it's about 8,000 jobs. It's jobs, and it's a big boost for rural America and our farmers and ranchers. So we need to continue to make that investment in agriculture. The research, the trade, to help, and the disaster programs to help our farmers and ranchers when they're in need. Thank you. I appreciate the opportunity to be here.
We have just a few minutes for questions. Yep. I'm going to start real quick. I'm Mark Oppold, RFD-TV. You mentioned food waste, and indeed families and restaurants, hotels, but a lot of it is due, Michael, to government regulations that are not allowed to give away the food at these restaurants that they serve. They have to, by regulations, throw them away. The government is part of the problem.
Well, I would disagree that the government is part of the problem. If you look at the portions that our restaurants are serving today, I think portion size has a great deal to do with the waste that we are experiencing today. If you look at, again, go to the restaurants, look at the portions that were currently being served, and then how much of that is left on that plate that goes back to a kitchen, that goes back into a disposal, we need to take a look at just what our portion size actually is. Yes?
Yeah. Brian Winnikins, WRDN in Durand, Wisconsin. You talked about the loss of farmland and how production, even with the loss of farmland, has continued to increase. In portions of the upper Midwest, we're seeing a large loss of farmland, including in Wisconsin, where they've started to do some programs to save that. At what point does USDA become concerned that we've had a loss of too much farmland and the new technology with the production can't keep up?
Well, if you look at, you know, the numbers that I gave earlier and what we've been able to accomplish, and you look at just what we've been able to do with corn yields over the last 10 years and the work that's now being done on soybeans and wheat, I think we're going to continue to see large increases in production in the United States in spite of the land that has been lost. But, you know, unfortunately, we need to take and not just look at today, but we need to take and look at what's going to happen. You know, I think all of you know the numbers that we've got to increase world food production by 70% between now and 2050 just to feed the demands of a growing world population. That's a tremendous amount of increase that we're going to have to experience in a very short period of time. So, I mean, there are parts of the country where losses of farmland are a major issue. Myself, coming from the state of Delaware, a very small state on the East Coast, the loss of farmland is an issue. Fortunately, in some of the states, we have really good ag lands preservation programs, but we're going to have to need to continue those programs. I think we're going to have the states and the counties and the municipalities are going to have to sit down and take a look at how we work with land use, how we do zoning, where we're starting to build, where we have the infrastructure to support growth, and so that we don't infringe on those areas where we have the very best farmland to produce the very best crops.
Mr. Secretary, a question for you here. There appears to be a social agenda in the country that doesn't just want food but wants to dictate the way it's produced. There appear to be end users who not only want that supply at a price but want it produced a particular way. And you also have a movement for ballot initiatives or legislation to dictate labels on foods that might include genetic traits that we're using to be productive. What of this social agenda, and what responsibility falls on the Department of Agriculture, falls on farmers, and falls even on the media? How do we peer through this paradigm of more food, cheap food?
I mean, that is a very difficult question to answer. You know, on one hand, the consumers do have, I think, the need to know what is in a particular product. But on the other hand, we also have consumers that want food produced at the most cost-effective way that it can be to keep the cost down to them, and how we reach that happy medium, I don't know how we're going to achieve that, but there is a reason why our consumers are spending less than 10% of their disposable income for food, and it depends on who you talk to what the number is. Some it's 7%, 8%, but there's a reason why, and it's because of the production techniques and the technology that we use to produce food for our consumers. There's a reason why that, you know, we have the most abundant, cost-effective, and safest food supply in the world. But there are those that, well, let's use organic as an example, that want, you know, organically produced food. And we do have the organic labeling, you know, for the foods, for our food out there. We put that in place, how many years ago now? 12 years ago? So, but we did accommodate those that, you know, want to have the organics, want to have it grown, have their food grown organically and marketed organically. So it's going to be a delicate balance as to how we accommodate both sides. I think you've seen some of the ballot initiatives fail. But we don't know what's going to, I can't answer what's going to happen in the future and how far they're going to go.
Big company owned by the person named Sam isn't wrong to say that we want our hogs to be raised this way, but yet it dictates a pace and form of production that isn't least cost. Some farmers would say not sustainable.
Exactly, and that's the balance that we're going to have to reach somehow, some way, because again, you know, there when you look at our consumers and what they want to pay for their food, there are some of the production techniques and technologies out there that, you know, are it's going to cost a lot more for our producers to produce that food. So that's also that's one of the things that's going to have to be taken into consideration. I mean, there's so many pennies per pound that you can squeeze out of whether it's pork production, beef production, or poultry. So if you're going to dictate that things have to be raised a certain way, there is a cost associated with that, and that has to be understood.
Secretary Andy Vance with Feedstuffs, so I'd follow up on your answer there. You and Dr. Witecki both made a pretty good case for agricultural technology, including biotechnology and GM crops. Friday, the department announced that it'd be preparing full environmental impact statements for a couple of products going through the deregulation process, and that kind of caught a lot of ag groups by surprise because it was a departure from the typical process that the department's gone through. What prompted that move, and does that serve as a little bit of a contradiction to the story that you and Dr. Witecki just told us for the importance of getting those products out in a timely fashion?
I don't think so. I think, you know, we want to attempt to get products out in a timely manner, make sure that all of the work that has been properly done before those products are, in fact, you know, approved for release. Biotechnology, again, is extremely important. We need to continue the growth and the development of products, disease-resistant products, pest-resistant products, which allow us to grow products in a more environmentally friendly manner and at the same time boost production. So, we look at a process to make sure that that we're going to be developing products that are, in fact, safe.
We're a little bit over time, but one more question, Mike Herbert.
Thank you. Mike Herbert, Red River Farm Network in Grand Forks. As you know, sugar prices are well below loan levels. How concerned are you about forfeitures of these loans, and what kinds of things are you looking at to avoid that, to prop up the price?
Well, it is a concern. We are looking at different ways, which I can't get into. I mean, we did have announced 2 weeks ago a waiver on our import exports. We are looking at other ways that we can hopefully prevent forfeitures of sugar. As was pointed out by the industry itself, last year was the perfect storm. We had a record beet crop, a record cane crop, as well as a huge crop in Mexico. So we went from the 3 years of deficits to 1 year of tremendous production that we are trying to deal with. But we are looking at any and all means right now to deal with the surplus that we currently have, not just in beet production, but down south in the cane production as well. So we continue to look at ways to prevent the forfeitures.
Mike, thank you for your time.
Thank you.
And the acting Secretary of Agriculture.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mike.